You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
This week's bits. The best news nuggets from Breakfast and The Wire from this week.
Atamariye, Kohana Ross Tokuingua, and welcome to this week's bits. This week was Fuck Off Fascism Week on BFM, so we're going to be looking at the best Fuck Off Fascism bits of the week. Monday, we looked at where fascism has come from and where it's actually going.
Bombastic Mussolini, the sawdust Caesar, comes to his end in the gutter, fitting climax to a life of treachery and double cross.
Fascism is clearly a product of the First World War, and without the First World War, we can't really understand it. It would never have come about, certainly not in the way it did. But obviously it has lots of precursors in the 19th century world, particularly in the 19th century European world. I think the most important of those are connected to a rising nationalism and a sense that people really did believe that their community, the people in their nation, and they considered it often on racial and ethnic basis, were organically connected and had a sense of unity to it, so that they could, if they, you know, sort of, the positive vision of this nationalism was, if they really made the most of that, then they could conquer the world and conquer other lesser peoples as well, and they would have the right to do that. So the second thing that really influenced the rise of fascism was the idea of some people call it social Darwinism, the right of certain groups, stronger groups, to rule weaker groups of people, and they based that on Darwin's theories of evolution, that in nature the strong outlast the weak and the stronger traits win out in the end, so that and they translated that into sort of human society. So stronger groups of human beings have the right to conquer those who are not as capable of looking after themselves and combining their resources and so forth.
Does Trump represent an American fascism? When comparing Trump to, say, Hitler, it is important to remember that Hitler did not campaign on a platform of world war or genocide. These were instead achieved through several years of gradualism, such as the suppression of dissent, the creation of racially segregated ghettos, and a foreign policy which promised to put Germany first.
A new national pride will stir our souls, lift our sights, and heal our divisions. It's time to remember that old wisdom our soldiers will never forget, that whether we are black or brown or white, we all bleed the same red blood of patriots. Together, we will make America great again.
In contrast, President Trump has dropped several of his more extreme policies as a candidate, such as a pledge to imprison his rival, Hillary Clinton. This does not mean his presidency is not part of the process towards an American fascism, but he is most likely not its final stage. This process predates Trump, of course, and so will continue after he leaves office. Will Republican voters simply return to the moderates Trump railed against during the primary, or will they be attracted to even more radical politicians?
Tuesday was Fascism, Propaganda and the Media.
Propaganda is an exceptionally important way of controlling the populace, either through patriotic fervour or fear, and it has always been widely used for those purposes. And they're not all brilliant at it, but for various reasons they all have the tool at their disposal. The Nazis, of course, were past masters at the use of propaganda. So it varies, but by and large, they all use it. I mean, in North Korea at the moment, uses propaganda throughout the lives of its inhabitants. We in the West would regard much of it as ham-fisted and rather silly, but it works there. So how good are they at using it? That's a difficult thing to say, but how effective most of them are very effective because of the other means of control that they have.
What sort of themes does it portray?
Well, first and foremost, the legitimacy of the regime that controls the population. The propaganda is there first and foremost to reinforce and give a form of legitimacy, usually a misplaced form of legitimacy, to the regime itself. So that's one side of it. When the regime finds itself in conflict with others, whether that be internal conflict by partisan groups or going to war with other nations, then it takes on an additional purpose of keeping people on a war front, either through patriotic fervor or warning them of the dire consequences of loss, of losing, of not being victorious, and so on. So it serves a range of purposes. I mean, some of the purposes are much more mundane. For example, it can be used and is used in those regimes for just keeping the place tidy.
Mm.
As simple as that. In communist China, there was a propaganda campaign to rid China of flies. So it's not all high-level stuff. Some of it is quite low-level.
Now, you mentioned Nazi Germany and how they were the masters at it. Of course, Goebbels is considered one of the forerunners of propaganda. How influential were his methods?
Oh, I think that his methods not only were influential, but continue to be influential. After the war, his diaries were analysed and a series of principles were extracted from them that Goebbels had followed in pursuing propaganda before and during the Second World War. And many of those principles, once you strip away the Nazi connotations, you can see that they're still in use today.
Wednesday, we asked the very insightful question of whether it was okay to punch a Nazi.
Is it okay to punch a Nazi?
Not a neo-Nazi.
You like black people?
Well, why not?
You might remember this video that went viral in January. Richard Spencer, the president of the white nationalist think tank, National Policy Institute, was giving a television interview when a member of the crowd comes up and punches him in the face.
It's become kind of a symbol.
The video sparked an online debate about the ethics of punching a Nazi. If people were espousing caustic, hateful views, then is it okay to respond to this with violence? Or is a violent approach totally out of bounds? And if you say no, it's not okay to punch a Nazi, then are you running the risk of seeming like you're siding with a fascist? First, my producer Adam spoke to Abigail Allen, the co-founder of Dayenu, New Zealand Jews Against Occupation. They identify with Antifa, or anti-fascist ideology, which is a global movement that advocates the eradication of fascism. Here's Adam.
Firstly, is it okay to punch a Nazi?
I think it's definitely okay to punch a Nazi. Their very existence denies the existence of a lot of people.
Right.
So I would say so. Their ideology is violent. So I think, if you're being threatened by violence, you should definitely act.
So the use of violence is permissible against their kind of message, essentially.
Oh, definitely.
So it's justifiable.
I would definitely say so.
I also spoke to Randy Cohen, who for 12 years wrote The Ethicist, a column about ethics for the New York Times. I started by asking him up front, yes or no, is it okay to punch a Nazi?
No, it is not. And I'm a little shocked that you would have to ask. Surely you know the answer to this, or you should call your mother or my mother. Call somebody's mother because they all know. No, we don't get to punch people because they have ideas that differ from ours. Even people like Richard Spencer, who I think you're referring to, who's he's an utterly despicable guy, who's an exponent of the vilest sort of ideas, but we don't get to punch him. As frustrating as that is, I know it's one of the great injustices of life. We have to combat speech with other speech. I'm not a pacifist. We have the right to self-defense, but self-defense is independent of the ideology of the people who are attacking us. You are allowed to defend yourself, and sometimes that requires physical force. That's that I don't have an ethical problem with that. But Richard Spencer at that moment wasn't physically attacking anybody. That punch in the nose wasn't in any sense self-defense.
Thursday gave us an understanding of what constitutes a modern-day fascist.
Do you think that the current global political situation, economically as well, that there are grounds fascism to rise up again, specifically in America?
Well, I think I was heartened by the way that the courts in the federal system seem to kind of stand up to some of Trump's, especially his very first decrees, you know, around immigration and the likes. You know, there seem to be a strong rule of law, a strong separation of powers. It's going to be a fight, but I think it seems to me that there is a system that is solid. So this is a roundabout. Okay, I'll get to answering your question. So it's just a roundabout way of doing it. There are some similarities, I think, in terms of a context of a long-term economic recession, you know, and concerns around immigration and xenophobia that do remind us of the interwar period, the 20s, the 30s, when fascism rose. I think, though, if there is a right-wing turn, a turn towards despotism, it won't look like fascism did in the 20s and 30s. So, to some extent, I think the label, trying to attach the label, a label that belongs at a very specific point in time, to contemporary events, is a bit of a distraction. But the point is that we have to defend civil rights. I believe we have to defend civil rights, democracy, social justice, and that's under threat, quite clearly.
And the media definitely seem on board with defending it. It's very interesting, especially seeing how hounded Trump is by the media. And in Europe as well, we've had very much rise of alt-right movements with Marine Le Pen and Geert Wilder, but they have been unsuccessful in reaching office. Do you think that that's significant?
Yeah, I think the defeat of Marine Le Pen is very significant, because it's quite possible, it's quite likely that it would have brought to the end of the EU. And the EU, for all its faults, does provide a kind of, you know, a democratic, philosophical, even kind of moral coherence to a collection of very diverse states, many of which are at risk of going back to fascism. I'm thinking of cases that your listeners may not be as familiar with, like Slovakia or Hungary with Jobbik, which is currently in power in coalition. It's an openly fascist party. Golden Dawn in Greece, the Northern League in Italy. So I think the strengthening the EU is really, and consolidating it and protecting it from really serious challenges like Brexit, is really important. And actually, since I mentioned Brexit, one thing that worried me immensely just yesterday in the aftermath of that terrible attack in Manchester, where commentators, even what you would call, you know, respectable journalists, somebody, I forget her name, from the Daily Telegraph, who tweeted in favor of internment of thousands of Muslims, kind of preventive internment. So you don't have to anymore go to the far, far right, or the alt-right, as I think you called it earlier, to find opinions, ideas that are being legitimized, that are clearly in the spectrum of fascism.
Finally, on Friday, to end the week off, we concluded with fascism and the arts, from musical protests to propaganda.
Fascism has a specific relationship with the marginalisation of minorities, and in many cases, these minorities have used music to speak out. The idea of musical protesting can be applied to many social movements. Some of the examples used here show a resistance to the rise of white supremacy and racism that stems from that. Strange Fruit, written by Abel Mirapol, is said to be inspired by the disgust he felt after seeing a photograph of lynching. The lyrics were given to Billie Holiday, who performed the song in a club called Cafe Society in New York in the 1930s. The song tackled violent racial hatred head-on at a time where protest music was somewhat unknown.
blood on the leaves and blood at the road. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
In a time where the response to a statement as bold as this song was uncertain, the response was overwhelming, with the entire cafe applauding. Protest music has been a part of advocating social movements for ongoing decades. Kanye West even sampled Strange Fruit on his track Blood on the Leaves, which was released in 2013. During the 70s, 80s and 90s, protest music was all around in all different genres. Many hip-hop groups in the 90s were protesting against white supremacy. Mathematics by Mos Def tackled institutional racism that stemmed from violent white supremacy groups.
We talking about here?
Yo, it's one universal law, but two sides to every story. Three strikes and you bitten for life, mandatory. Four MCs murdered in the last 4 years. I ain't trying to be the fifth when the millennium is here. Yo, it's 6 million ways to die from the seven deadly thrills. 8-year-olds getting found with 9 mils.
It has been said that hip-hop has returned to politics in recent years. Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly marked the resurgence of political music in rap. The rise is suspected to come after several cases of police brutality on African Americans in the US drew the nation's attention, and now conversations about injustice and inhumane racism are happening more than ever as the far right escalates in popularity. The outro to Mortal Man by Kendrick Lamar exemplifies this and is spoken word poetry that goes like this.
But while my loved ones was fighting a continuous war back in the city, I was entering a new one. A war that was based on apartheid and discrimination made me want to go back to the city and tell the homies what I learned. The word was respect. Just because you wore a different gang color than mine's doesn't mean I can't respect you as a black man.
Last year, A Tribe Called Quest released We the People following the US election, solidifying the resurgence of political protest music in our current global climate. The song is a rallying cry addressing the racism, xenophobia, homophobia, and misogyny that seems to have plagued society.
Niggas in the hood living in a fishbowl. Gentrify here, now it's not a shithole. Trendsetter, I know my shit's cold. Hand sentiment because I ain't so bold. But yeah, all you black folks, you must go.
I also spoke to Dr. Kara Kremlin about the relationship between fascism and pop culture as a whole. Do you think there's a relationship between fascism and or the resistance of fascism to arts and pop culture?
I think that one has to be careful about overstating the influence that popular culture can have in changing political sensibilities.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is something to be said about that. For example, on my popular culture course, in the first lecture, I show 10 images for 0.2 of a second each.
Mm.
And they're images of celebrities, of movie posters, brands, and so forth.
Yeah.
And as sure as a dog smells blood, the students, seemingly without any delay, can recognize each of those posters, icons, and so forth. And I think if you conduct an experiment in most cities around the world, you'd probably find the same thing.
Yeah.
And so in a way, our sensibilities are being franchised by the movie industry, by the video game industry, by celebrity culture and advertising on a global scale. And, and the influence that those images have on us is evident in everyday life.
Thanks to all of those who helped contribute to Fuck Off Fascism Week.
That was this week's Bits. To listen to the full interviews, visit 95bfm.com and check out the BCasts.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/BCasts.